Hey everybody, welcome to the Mind Shift Lab. Each week, we're gonna bring you a new guest to share exercises, strategies, and concepts to help you create an internal shift that drives external results in business, the arts, sports, and life. Today, I have with me Richard Curtis. Rich is a CEO of Future Brand Australia. With a master's degree in Literae Humanorius from Oxford University, he started his career in Bangkok as an account planner before switching to media planning in London. Since arriving in Australia in 2001, he has contributed to a wide range of significant branding programs, all in the name of driving business transformation, and many which have been awarded by D&AD, Cannes Lions, Brand New, Rebrand, and Transform. He works with clients and companies that over the years have included some of the world's most recognized local, meaning Australian, and global brands to create brand strategies, identities, and experiences to grow their business. Rich has been featured by Ad News in their 40 Under 40 list of rising stars in advertising, marketing, and media. And he was one of 20 visionaries invited to speak at Vivid on the future landscape of design and creativity in 2020. He's also the founder of 33, a social initiative dedicated to giving time to people who need brand and marketing help. Rich, super excited to have you with us today. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here. Shame we can't be in person in LA. That'd be fun. But this will do.
We'll do live in person next time you're in town.
For sure.
Awesome. Hey, let's dive right in here. Can you give us a high-level overview of kind of where you started to where you're at today to give people context as to what you're going to share?
Yeah, sure. So, like, if we go, like, right back to the start, I had a Hungarian mother who instilled a ridiculous work ethic in me. And then a dad who I think probably left school at maybe 14, 15. And so it was a big deal all around when I then got into Oxford. Like I remember my dad was like super emotional about it. It was almost as though kind of that was their job done. They'd kind of given me a good education and a good work ethic. And then from there, I went off to live in Bangkok because I didn't want to do the cliche thing of, you know, joining a grad program and for an accountancy firm or a law firm. I wanted to do something completely different and take myself out of the ordinary. Managed to get myself a job locally in Bangkok for Dentsu Young and Rubicam, which was a JV between Dentsu, the Japanese ad agency, and YNR, American ad agency. Then came back to London. The bit that isn't in my little bio that you read out is I tried to be a film director. That didn't last so long, but it was kind of fun. I was doing a lot of writing at the ad agency in Bangkok. And I've always enjoyed writing. I've always enjoyed words. I guess there's a couple of little phrases I suppose that bring that to life. You know, one is like in branding, I think language is massively underrated. And so I'll often say that, you know, the two most popular words in branding are lorem ipsum, and it's true. And everyone laughs every time I say it. It never grows old, but it's true. People just kind of overemphasize the visual side of branding and don't spend enough time thinking about words and language when it comes to creating brands. And then kind of my version of cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, which is, I speak, therefore I am. Like everything for me is about kind of how I put things into words, so much so that my kind of behavioral type, as it was explained to me, is, you know, you're the kind of person who knows what you think as soon as you hear yourself say it. Which is super scary when you're doing a podcast because you don't quite know what you think and you only know what you think once you hear yourself say it. But yeah, It was that love of language that I then wanted to take into directing, essentially, and not necessarily Hollywood blockbusters or anything like that. It was, little shorts and music videos, so a visual element, but a kind of a storytelling kind of part to it too. So yeah, so I tried that for a while, and then I met a girl, fell in love. She was Australian, came back to Australia, or came to Australia. I'd never been to Australia before. And then, now we're married, three kids. And then in the time that I've been in Australia, I've worked for three global branding companies. So firstly Landor, then Interbrand, and now Futurebrand. So it's not necessarily been a straight line. I know it looks very neat and tidy, but there's been a few zigzags in there. But it's been fun.
What were some things that you did? This wasn't in the list that I sent you, but what are some creative things that you did as a kid? Were you into the arts or anything when you were younger?
Yes and no. So, weirdly enough, the only creative thing I can and like that's kind of pseudo artistic is my mum, and this is a classic example perhaps of my mum's mentality. I remember vividly, she would give us like a glass or a jar of water and a paintbrush, and she'd tell us that we could paint the patio, and we thought this was amazing. But of course, it would dry pretty quick and you'd have to start again. So I don't know whether that was kind of creativity or some kind of weird punishment on her part. But I don't remember being particularly creative necessarily. Like, I've always loved music, and not that I've got any musical skills whatsoever, but I spent a lot of my childhood singing songs and that kind of thing, I guess. But it wasn't a particularly creative upbringing necessarily. It was a very rigid work ethic. That I still have, I suppose, as part of my DNA today. Like, if I really need to get things done, then I'm perfectly happy to do a 9 p.m. till midnight, 1 in the morning, or I can do a 5 till 8 in the morning. Either will work for me. But yeah, I wouldn't say it was particularly creative necessarily. I think it was the 80s. I was kind of funneled down a particular road in terms of what educational success might look like.
Yeah. How is your so I'm a big believer in bringing to access creativity, bringing in things outside of your space, right? How is your degree in from Oxford? I can't even I pronounce it once right, and I don't want to say it again because I think I'm gonna screw it up. Maybe I didn't do it right the first time. But like your degree in Latin and ancient Greek, how has that influenced your path at all?
Yeah, it has. It definitely has. So, in many respects, it's not a million miles away from what I do now, right? Which is reading a whole lot of source material, albeit it's about branding and business rather than, ancient Greek, theatre. Reading a whole lot of source material, working out what you think of it, building that into an argument and selling it. And so there's the analytical thing side of things in terms of being able to understand what it means, and then the ability to build a cogent argument that can win people over. So there's definitely that aspect to it in terms of strategic thinking, and then the other aspect is the love of language. And the really cool thing about Latin and ancient Greek, and that might not be a sentence that's appeared on your show much, Latin and ancient Greek being cool. But the really cool thing is in those languages, you can put words in whatever order you want them to be, and the sentence will still make sense based on how words are connected to one another. But by placing those words in different orders, you can change the emphasis of any given sentence. And so, even talking regularly, rather than in kind of poetry or anything like that, but just regular language, then has this whole extra level of color and texture that you don't quite get in English. So, it might say, "Hey, I'm on a podcast today," and that's kind of the regular way of saying it. But if you want to stress the immediacy, you might say, "Well, today I'm on a podcast," or "You'll never guess what I'm going to be on today. It's a podcast." And so all of those things are reflected in English, but there isn't quite the same flexibility. But that creativity in terms of word placement, it's something that's really important in comedy, for example. Like when you write a gag and when you write a joke, the kind of the funny bit, the really funny bit is meant to be the very last word that you say. And so all those things around sentence structure, why words mean what they do, definitely helps, in all the naming work that we do in terms of creating new names. But all of that in terms of tenses and sentence structures and, how you create words, all of that I think has absolutely informed my love of language. And also, a large part of what I do is not just the creativity, or a large part of what we do is not just the creativity in terms of developing the ideas, but then also the creativity to be able to spark someone else's imagination to get equally excited about it. And so, one of the other things actually that isn't in my bio is when I was in my teens, I really wanted to be a defense barrister, criminal defense barrister, and lawyer, a barrister and lawyer. So solicitors are a bit more behind the scenes. Barristers are the ones in the court of law, duking it out with the other side in front of the judge. The creativity in terms of pulling together a really inspiring, motivating argument to convince people that your idea is better than theirs, basically. There's a huge amount of creativity that we put into that to make sure that our ideas do get across the line, because otherwise so many great ideas just never see the light of day because you just didn't pitch them right or sell them right.
When I was first starting out with in my basketball business, I hated marketing, sales, like anything that had to do with that. I just wanted to coach basketball. And I had a dad tell me, he's like, basically, you have to get good at sales and marketing, or you're never gonna have a business. He's like, you can be the best, like you can have the best idea, you can have the best campaign you want to pitch to a client, right? Whatever it is, but if you don't know how to communicate that, you don't know how to sell yourself, it's as if you don't even exist. And so that was definitely something I had to learn. Sticking with creativity, what are some keys to unlocking that? Maybe for somebody who doesn't think that they're creative.
Yeah, I mean, creativity is a really weird thing. And I feel, quite lucky insofar as I feel, quite comfortable coming up with ideas. And I tend to come up with a lot of ideas. And if you talk to my team, there's always kind of weird and wonderful, often nonsensical ideas that kind of come up. But I think half the challenge is not necessarily coming up with them, but actually working out which ones are good. And I think there's a real sensitivity there. So something I talk to my kids about actually is just the difference between writing and editing. They're two very different skill sets. Writing or coming up with ideas is super expansive and anything goes. Whereas editing or kind of selecting those ideas or refining them in some way is a much more reductive exercise. And I think a lot of people, I think there's one issue, which is, okay, how can I come up with ideas and how can I come up with more of them? And that, there's myriad books you can read about that. But in some respects, I feel as though the other side of the equation is perhaps even more important in terms of stopping yourself from editing yourself or from censoring your own ideas before they even get a chance to get out there. And so I'm pretty certain most people have more ideas than they realize, or are more creative than they realize. It's just those ideas never get to kind of germinate or grow to the point at which they might look like ideas according to the dictionary definition. And so if you allow that creativity to come out of you and those ideas to come out of you, then I think you might actually surprise yourself when you least expect it. And so, that idea, so writing, for example, a creative writing technique is just to write and don't let the pen or pencil stop moving. And in this weird and wonderful way, the story kind of starts to write itself. And it might be gobbledygook, it might be meaningless for half a dozen lines. And then something takes over. I don't know what it is, but I don't know whether it's unlocking the subconscious. But there is a creative writing technique where you just start writing. And so I think that's really important. And I've, talk to my kids about that and get them to do that, get them to, close their eyes and think and block out all other stimulus just so you can focus on what might be inside of your imagination. And so, in some respects, what I'm saying is don't focus on trying to be creative. Actually, just focus on removing those blockers where you might censor or edit yourself, whether consciously or subconsciously. And if you can just remove those things, then you actually find that you open the floodgates without trying to be creative. You're just removing the things that are holding you back in some way or other. So that's, I think that is a big thing. And then part of my job professionally is not necessarily coming up with the ideas, but then helping to identify which ones we think might have legs, or which ones might be worth pursuing, or which ones might be winners, so to speak. And I think that's an equally creative task, because you're looking at these very fragile things that are incomplete and unfinished and quite raw, and in some respects wrong. But you have to have that imaginative capacity to foresee how they could evolve, or at least give them half a chance if you kind of pump the tires up on them. And look, sometimes you'll find you're flogging a dead horse, quite possibly. But you'll never die. You'll never know unless you kind of give it a whirl. I mean, obviously some don't have legs, but I think there's equal parts creativity, and then how do you identify which are the ideas that have greater possibility, greater utility, and then editing them is not purely a reductive task. There is creativity applied to that. But I think just understanding what the barriers might be and being able to remove them, and then just knowing where you are in that creative journey, and that they're very separate and distinct disciplines. I think if you try and do it all in the one go, that's where you just start getting into tailspins and it goes kind of wrong and just becomes frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, I love so much of the stuff that you brought up. I think, two of the big takeaways are, number one, just get to action. Just start writing, get the pen to paper, right? So many times we sit around waiting for the inspiration. I think I talked to somebody else about this, who was on the show, that we have this misconception that artists just, they're lazy and they just wait around for inspiration. And then when it hits, then they write that magical piece, right? But it's actually like they're doing the work every day. And they're throwing away 99% of the things that they're coming up with, right? So I think it's, the action and getting to action with a place of being in a place of non-judgment, right? So how do you get your people to not censor themselves, to not filter themselves, to create a space, a work environment where they feel safe enough to give you a horrible idea, whether that is gonna happen or not, right? That just to get all the information to flow through, so then you can't, because as soon as, like what you talked about, right? As soon as I start to judge that one answer, it blocks everything else from coming through. So how do you get your people to just let all of that flow and not censor themselves?
Yeah, it's a really hard thing, because on the one hand, you're wanting to encourage people that failure or mistakes or bad ideas or anything goes is okay. And on the other, you've got people paying you good money to be right. And it's really quite hard. And there's this unreasonable, slightly irrational thing that happens in our business whereby, you know, people want a guarantee that these ideas that you're going to come up with are going to work. And at the same time, they'll be telling you, I want something new and different, but can you also just make sure it's going to work? And can you also give me some proof that it's worked before? And it's like, well, hang on a tick, I thought you wanted new and different. And so it's a really quite murky, quite confusing set of dynamics, you know, in which you then find yourself existing and trying to work productively. So I think on the one hand, you know, you have to have that, people have to have that psychological safety that, you know, it's okay to be wrong, come up with bad ideas, make mistakes.
How do you whatever it might be to them?
Pardon?
How do you communicate that to them? Like, is there any, do you have any, I'm just totally making this up, but like, do you ever have a 30-second session where it's just free flow ideas, there's no judgment zone, right? I have no idea what the process is, but.
Yeah, so I would love to say that I've kind of worked out some brilliant formula. But like with most things in life, it's kind of informal learning and experiences. So, you know, it's everything from the fact that, you know, I'm often saying, if we're not making mistakes, we're not trying hard enough, you know, which is something I read way back in the day. And I fundamentally believe, I think you have to roll the dice and try new things. And that's something I'm always looking to do, you know, in my own work life and career and so forth. So, you know, part of it is just being very vocal around the fact that we're going to try some stuff, we're going to break some stuff, not all of it's going to work. But, you know, words will only get you so far. You know, some of it is role modeling and making people feel comfortable, you know, coming up with silly ideas or ridiculous ideas or things that might be a little bit nonsensical. And just signaling through your actions, you know, that it's okay. So, you know, one of the things that we sometimes do for ourselves and sometimes with clients is a thing called the impossible challenge. And so that is where you, as a creative exercise to liberate your mind, you know, you might set an impossible question. So if we were doing it right here, right now, you know, we'd go, you know, we're halfway through we've recorded the first half of the show. How can we record the second half straight off the bat in person? And you've got 3 minutes at one idea per post-it note, because of course post-it notes are involved. You've got 3 minutes to come up with as many ideas for how Mike and me can do the second half of this recording in person. And ridiculous ideas come up because it's an impossible question. But I think when you have that freedom, when you kind of liberate your mind in that way, and it's a creative exercise that I think we picked up from another kind of innovation type consultancy in Australia. But those sorts of things really free your mind. And they can be really useful in brainstorms or co-creation sessions or collabs or whatever it might be, as little kind of breakers through the day to kind of cleanse the mind, much like an amuse-bouche over dinner might cleanse the palate. So just, you know, people, and I think the other thing is that we're kind of actions speak louder than words is, you know, when people make mistakes, Not necessarily in a creative context, but in any kind of business context, just them knowing that you've got their back is super important. And so, I'm pretty certain, because we've had conversations about it, that my team, my people, know that, whatever happens, I'll always support them. I might criticize them or have feedback that challenges them, or there's things that they have done wrong that they need to fix or we need to fix in some way because we didn't do what we were meant to do. But all the way through that process, you can still do that and have someone's back and make them feel like they've got your support. And that might just be a human thing, right? Rather than a creative thing per se in terms of teamwork and collaboration. But I think it's a combination of, from a leadership point of view, words and actions and role modeling, and just kind of being there with them. So I don't, it's not the creative kind of exercises and some kind of rah-rah activity that you can do in a workbook necessarily. I think it's more just how teams work and how teams function. And you can make them feel comfortable that whether it's a creative idea or a suggestion that, something we should do for a client, whatever it might be, that people feel that they can offer up those ideas and it could be the start of something interesting. I mean, I'm a, I think big believer in kind of serendipity as well, which is why offices, have an important role to play in, creative cultures where you just kind of randomly bump into people or randomly see something on someone else's computer. It's not the whole story necessarily. But it goes back to, I think it goes back to how you kind of manage change or foster an environment that enables creativity. I don't think you can focus on the change or the creativity or the thing necessarily. It's about creating a certain kind of environment, and then people will respond to that environment. So if you create a safe place, then it means that people might make more, come up with more dangerous ideas, in response to the safety they feel, in their kind of work and environment. So that's always been my focus, the environment rather than the people per se, or kind of some wonderful little kind of activity that you might be able to do.
So you brought up connect or challenging people and being in a place where you might have to criticize them or to provide them with feedback on work. And I think a mistake that a lot of newly like emerging leaders make is they go right into that without developing a relationship with people first. Can you speak to that at all? Like how important that relationship is, and then maybe expand on what you had to learn going from being in a manager or a doer role, more so when you're on the account side and everything, to more your leadership role now, and kind of what you had to learn as you move your way up.
Yeah, look, it's a really, really good question. And it's something it's really important to get right, because the other side of that equation around psychological safety, coming up with ridiculous ideas that might never work, that might actually hopefully work, and all of that. At the same time, for the work that we do, or the goals and ambitions we set ourselves, at the same time, you have to have these ridiculously high standards for what success looks like. And that's a really tortured conflict, a really tortured contradiction. And it's one that like I've struggled with in terms of how do you get that balance right. And it's funny, it was only probably a few weeks ago that I had some feedback from one of my team where I'd made that point about, I worry that Maybe at times there's kind of too much freedom and too much latitude, and you need to be firmer on what the kind of the standards of success are, which I know runs counter to much of what I've said already, right? But I guess these are the struggles that you have when you're thinking about commercial success. But I was pleased, and I must admit a little bit surprised perhaps, but I was pleasantly surprised that there is that expectation that I've been able to set around the standards to which we aspire. And I think a lot of that, to answer your question more specifically, I think a lot of that comes down to team sports. And my leadership style, I think, if I can not sound too self-indulgent talking about myself like this, but I've always felt a lot of my leadership style comes back to team sports and playing team sports at school and then at university. And as the captain of a team, you're always on the pitch with your players. And I think that's the perfect analogy for how I've always led teams and run businesses. I'm not the guy on the sidelines or sat up in the stands in the coach's box. I've always been on the pitch with the rest of the team, quite hands-on. And so that has put me in a position where I can role model what I think success looks like. And look, I'm the first to acknowledge that, I think I might, when I think I might be wrong. But at the same time, if I've got a belief or a conviction, then I'm more than happy to kind of lead the team from the front, and give them the confidence that they might need that we're headed in the right direction. Therefore, they can do all the creative stuff, off the back of that. Sometimes part of my job is removing some of the barriers that the clients with whom we're working or the organizations with whom we're working might have when it comes to, then enabling the creativity of the team. But for me, and everyone's different, right? But for me, a lot of that leadership, if you like, has just come from that team sports environment where you are one of the team. And so you're asking people to judge you by your actions, not just your words. And I'm pretty certain, pretty confident I can say hand on heart, I've never asked anyone in any of my teams to do something that I haven't already done myself in some way, shape, or form. And that can be quite a powerful thing. Sometimes it's unconscious, it's just your character, it's just your DNA. Sometimes it's more considered in terms of things that I might do to signal how seriously I'm taking something, or how, what my position might be on a specific subject. Not in a way that's manipulative, albeit, of course you're kind of trying to motivate people. So it's a bit of a fine line between what's manipulation and what's motivation, right? But it's always been a kind of a, be on the field with the team, and being able to call the shots shoulder to shoulder, because then they know you're feeling what they're feeling. So I think that's a large part of what's mo kind of guided kind of how I've approached it. But again, like, I couldn't tell you why that might be. That's just naturally kind of how it's played out for me. It's not a decision I made at some point in time. That's just something I've reflected on at a certain point in my career, recognized it, and was like, okay, well, this is the way it's going to be. Off we go.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of things that we pick up as kids playing sports that we don't really attribute to something that we learned. It was just because we were immersed in this experience, and that's just what you did. And but now you can reverse engineer it and teach it to other people, even though it's something that wasn't directly taught to you in some leadership workshop that you went to or whatever it is, right? it's something that you've been able to reverse engineer and probably have instilled in the people that are also working with you.
Hey everybody, Mike Lee here. I know if you're listening to our show, that means you're a bold, driven, and future-focused leader looking to challenge the status quo and get to the next level. Which is why I've created a guide that blends the worlds of sports performance psychology with mindfulness on how to lock in and consistently deliver world-class, resilient performance in any arena of business or life. You can grab your copy by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the other thing to kind of come back a little to the point around creativity is I'm a big music fan, massive music fan. And I suppose the part of the parallel here is kind of that whole sentiment that music is, I'm listening to an English band called The Coral, who are from near Liverpool, and they've just released this epic double album that's a concept album about a seaside town in summer where everything's beautiful and happy and bright and cheery, and then in winter when all the crowds have gone and it's quite doom and gloom and desolate. Very, very cool. And then it's very cool. And but then the other thing I came back to yesterday, I don't know why, randomly, I was sat on a flight and it popped up in my kind of music. And this is a bit closer to home, but Thurston Moore, the guitarist out of Sonic Youth. American band, come on, Sonic Youth. So that, and that's more kind of experimental rock drone kind of stuff. So anyway, but like a lot of music is derivative, right? You kind of, a lot of musicians, you know, the Noel Gallaghers of the world, for example, from Oasis, if you have ever heard of them. Yeah? You know? Yeah. So like he'll always describe himself as a bit of a magpie in terms of stealing bits and pieces, you know, from different places, right? And I think that is a part of creativity whereby you kind of beg, steal and borrow stuff from other arenas and kind of bring them into what it is that you might be doing, not in a way that's plagiarism, like it is about, you know, being inspired. And I think that's one of the benefits of working in an agency, right, is you get to work on a whole range of different things, and they each inform and inspire the other in ways that you might not necessarily expect or anticipate. And so that diversity and fluidity of inputs and stimuli, I think, is also really important for creativity and can provide you a bit of a jumping off point to whatever the next thing might be. So there's that very famous quote by the person whose name I now can't remember, but it might come back to me. Let's hope it does. Which is that, you know, the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And so what that kind of distribution means that, you know, people experience that future at different points in time. So, you know, I'm massively into music, right? So I will kind of hear things before you do. I'm kind of living your musical future. Or in terms of leadership and coaching, you know, you're an early adopter on a whole range of different things. And so you're living a future that, you know, I might finally enter into in, you know, 4 or 5 years time, right? And so you can look at other industries or other areas that are ahead of you and kind of experience their future. You know, you can look at fintech, for example, and say, well, you know, they're advanced, et cetera, et cetera. What might that mean for our sector as, you know, these things start to mainstream? And so William Gibson was the quote. I knew it would come back to me. So I think that's interesting in terms of being able to get inspiration points from elsewhere. And the other point that comes into that around kind of diverse thinking is collaboration. And I think this is more important now than ever. The idea of collaborating with a whole range of diverse people or kind of diverse influences that you might not have exposed yourself to. And the whole point of that collaboration through diversity is not to kind of have this, you know, wonderfully seamless collaborative partnership, because collaboration isn't like that. It's actually quite difficult. And the whole point of collaboration, I think, is not simply to work together in a way where you help one another, but also to work together in a way that you challenge one another. And through that challenge comes the growth, because you're forced to think differently about things that you might have taken for granted, or expectations you might have had, or conventions in which you might have always believed, or conventions that you might have always followed. And I think anything that can kind of pull apart at that world of conventions and help you break it up and unpack it, then puts you in a better position to put these things back together in a different order that I think is equally creative. Like, the component parts might be the same, but I think that diversity of perspective and how you collaborate and how others challenge you fuels growth. And I think a lot of creativity comes down to, well, how are you going to grow? How is it going to change and evolve you? And so, you know, putting yourself in a position where you can feel challenged, I think, is an important part of creativity. Because if everyone's the same, it all kind of gets quite boring and quite bland. And I think now more than ever, we need the creativity and the diversity that can really give much more texture to our lives than ever before.
Yeah, I think there's a big parallel between creativity and performance. And where I'm going with this is, there's an author by the name of Daniel Coyle. He wrote a book called The Talent Code. And one of the things he talks about when you're developing talent is, you don't want to be so far outside of your comfort zone that things become so frustrating that you want to quit. But you don't want to be so in your comfort zone, so comfortable with something that it becomes boring. Right? You want to be at that step right outside your comfort zone, and where you're having some success, but you're also having a little bit of failure. So you're challenged, right? And then you step a little bit more outside your comfort zone, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And eventually now you've made this big leap, right? And I think that's that same with creative process, right? If you go put yourself in that position where you think you're doing the impossible, right? You're going to create so much frustration.
Yeah. And look, I've been there. You know, I guess I've been there three times. You know, so when I left university and went to Thailand to live in Bangkok, I don't know why I did it. I can't tell you why I did it. I can't remember the decision-making process, but it was absolutely, I do know that it was about doing something different, something that was atypical. And then when I went to Australia, albeit I did that for love, I don't remember kind of processing that as a decision. I just remember kind of thinking it was, you know, the right thing to do, but I didn't have a clue, you know, how that was going to work out. And I definitely didn't think about the long-term implications of living on the other side of the world from your family post-pandemic. Sorry, Mum. But the one time I did think about it consciously, and this is the most recent example, is when I left my previous role to join Future Brand. Like, I very consciously reflected on where I was at, and I felt comfortable. And I knew in my previous role, there'd be surprises, there would be unexpected things that might happen. But rather than the range of kind of what might happen being like wide open, I knew that those surprises would probably be quite a narrow corridor. And I felt, I knew I would come in, things would kind of play out a certain way. And I distinctly remember at the time in taking this, my next role to join Future Brand, you know, that I was accidentally on purpose kind of blowing up my career in order to restart and put myself in a completely different context where no one knew me, and to start again, to build those relationships and build that trust and do something completely new and different, which sounds amazing and brave and courageous and entrepreneurial on paper, but you really do have to be careful what you wish for, because it was hard, really, really hard. And I don't think I quite realized how hard it would be. I never at any point thought of quitting. But yeah, it's a very difficult thing to do once you're in it. It's a big deal to kind of just completely, and look, it's not as though I kind of changed industries or anything like that necessarily. It probably doesn't sound as big a deal to, you know, people listening in on this, but it was a purposeful, okay, this is a do-over. I'm going to try and go back to the start here and challenge myself to think differently about the world. It comes back to that point I made earlier, right, around change. It's very difficult to sit at your desk going, I'm going to change. It just isn't going to happen. You have to change the environment, and then you'll respond differently as a result of that. So it wasn't necessarily kind of a change of job per se. It was more, how do I give myself a completely different environment in which to do my thing? And I think, yeah, I think that's, yeah, I think what you're saying is totally right. But if you actually do it properly, it's a really scary thing. But it's, you know, you just got to stick with it. And I certainly, you know, am grateful for the opportunities that have come my way as a consequence of that. But yeah, sometimes you just got to do it.
So one of the things you talked about before that was super important was role modeling. What do you do every day to set yourself up to be at your best? Do you have any rituals, routines, habits, anything that you're doing in order for you to show up at your best for everybody that you're leading?
I do, but, and I wish I knew what they were, which I know sounds counterintuitive, right? But sometimes, you know, things are so moving so quickly that you kind of don't really appreciate what those habits might be. So I write a lot of things down. So one of the things I was taught maybe 5 years ago now, and not just taught, but shown, you know, the brain is an amazing thing in terms of analyzing and processing information. But if it's that powerful a machine, why do you leave the house without your keys and forget stuff, you know? So it's amazing at processing information, terrible at remembering things. And so I was kind of taught that and kind of shown that. And so one of my habits is definitely writing everything down. And back to the point right at the start about creativity and ideas, I'll write stuff down and I don't know why I'm keeping a note of it, but I'll write a note and it might be useful one day. So writing stuff down is definitely part of the ritual, and kind of having a to-do list. I'm not kind of as buttoned down as some people on the to-do list, but I think it's about productivity in terms of freeing up your mind so that it can just analyze and process and make decisions and not have to worry about remembering things, because it's not very good at remembering things. You know, like the quote earlier, you know, where I can't remember the person's name, you know, it's terrible, right? So that's, see, there you go. So that's definitely a thing. I mean, some of these might not sound particularly strategic or inspiring. You know, trying not to drink too much coffee is definitely helpful. Trying to get enough sleep. Trying not to get angry with my kids. And a lot of these start with trying. And I think just always, like, spending a lot of time talking to the team and in a healthy, productive way, you know, letting them know, you know, I'm there, I guess. But I'm not big on, I don't have lots of rituals and habits. This is why I say I do, but I don't know what they are. I'm sure if you asked the team, I'm sure they would tell you all the inspired and kooky things that I might do, half of them without realizing. But I think that the big one for me is just writing stuff down, and freeing up your mind to be able to make the decisions and do the things that your brain is really good for. And the other thing I do, actually, which goes hand in hand with that, is, and it kind of goes back to the diversity thing as well, like, I am not great in the same space all day long. Like, I've never had an office. I've always sat, going back to the team thing actually as well, I've always sat out on the floor with everyone else. I've never had some kind of special office with, you know, expensive furniture and artwork on the wall. It's just never been my thing, right? And so open spaces, you know, if in any office environment, you'll probably find me in the foyer, just kind of hanging out on my laptop. You know, I might go for walks. You know, I might work and tour three different places in the one day. That change of scenery, you know, I think is important. And then the other thing is music. I won't necessarily kind of curate my day according to what I'm listening to, but you know, even for this, I had to kind of turn off the stereo to kind of do this so that you didn't have some strange drone in the background, right? But I think, you know, between kind of music and space, you know, those two things together keep me on track. Like, if I'm in a shitty mood, I can change that in an instant by putting on a piece of music that I love. And oftentimes, you know, I might do that unconsciously, or I'll just move, I'll just stop and just go somewhere else. And the other thing actually that I teach my kids, or try to teach my kids, is there's another strategy where you finish, where you stop something halfway through, so that when you then come back to it, you're literally in the middle of a sentence, and so you know exactly where to pick up. So there's lots of writers who do that. They will pens down at the end of the day, mid sentence, mid thought, mid storyline, so that when they come back to it the next day, they know exactly where they are to start up again. Whereas if you're at the end of a chapter or the end of a thought, well, then there's a bit of a gap or a lull, and you've kind of got to get yourself back into it. So I think that's another thing that I might do, is like purposefully leave things halfway through. And look, they're all coming flooding there. And the other thing I change is format. So I might write something on the laptop, but then to edit it, I'll print it out on paper. Or if it's all on the laptop, I might just go somewhere else and I might have written it in my study, but then I'll go outside or go to the office or wherever I might be and review it then, whether it's a different place or a different time of day, but leave some distance, whether that's time or geographical kind of distance, to then just have a different mindset when you come to it. And I think part of that is almost adopting a different persona or a different perspective, you know, which is so important, again, for the work that we do, because all of our creativity is in the service of fulfilling or inspiring or kind of that customer need, you know, what you want people to do as a result of it. You know, I was, again, something I was taught way back at the start of my career or kind of was shared with me way back at the start of my career is that, you know, the objective of communication is to evoke a response, you know, whether that response is laughter, understanding, agreement, disagreement, but you're looking for, you know, for a response on the other side of the equation, right? And so you have to be thinking about how whatever creative idea you come up with, how that's going to be received. And so I think by changing location, having a separation of time, doing it on a different format, you know, by printing it out, something I've typed up on my laptop or whatever it might be, you know, or it might be that I take notes, scribble on that, and then as I'm writing it into an electronic kind of format, I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound so good. Or reading it out loud. I'll often get my kids, I know we're talking a lot about my kids, but I'll often get my kids to read stuff out loud. And you can see them as they're reading it. They're like, huh, this doesn't sound so good. And so I think anything that you can do to change up your perspective, just look at, like, quite literally, quite physically, look at something from a different angle. Anything you can do around that, I think, enables your ability to see an idea for what it might be or what it can be. And so I think that's also, you know, a large part of, I suppose, my creative practice, if you can call it that, you know, is just the, I think there's an undercurrent of diversity, if you like, for how to keep ensuring that you can give yourself a fresh perspective, you know, wherever that might come from. So they are some of the things that I've only probably realized I do now that you've asked me the question.
Those are all awesome. I think one, I'm a huge, huge believer in your emotional state and your energy, right? I think everything kind of flows from there. And the two things you talked about to shift those are like your environment and music, which I could have a whole conversation about those two things. I just think, you know, if we can manage our state, if I'm in a really good state of high energy and I feel free and open, right, I'm going to create my best work. If I'm stressed out and I'm worried about something, I'm never going to create my best work when I'm in that state. And if we can just focus on our state and then like set an intention, everything else kind of will flow from there, I think. I think that's a huge piece of being in that creative space. I just want to ask you one more thing and then we can jump off here, but things are kind of back to normal in Australia. Other parts of the world are still going through a lot of adversity. What would you say to somebody who's trying to lead their organization, their team, their family, right, through the adversity that we've all been dealing with for the past 15 months?
It's a tough question, because you can never presume to know what other people might be feeling or experiencing. But all I can really do, I suppose, is share my experience. And this is actually, you know, how we met. So 33, this social initiative that I accidentally started, it was actually an idea of a friend of mine. You know, I commuted an hour and a half each way to work. And so, in the, you know, once the pandemic kicked in, I wasn't commuting anymore, and so I had this extra time at each end of the day. And so I, well, the idea, not mine, my mate Dave, who actually works in the business, but the idea was to give that commuting time to anyone who might need brand and marketing advice or help in whatever shape or form that might be. And so that was this random idea. And I was like, who knows if anyone's going to be interested? And it turned out lots of people were interested. And then I had to try and manage it. And so it kind of evolved into 33, which is the idea that there were 30-minute sessions three times a day. Very kind of functional name. So through kind of lockdown, my days would start at 7:30 in the morning, 8:30. I would have three conversations with completely random people, like your good self at a certain point in time. And it would be, hey, how are you going? How can I help? And I never knew what it was that they might want to ask me about. But lots of people kind of organized time with me and kind of booked in and had lots of kind of conversations with super interesting people or super interesting challenges. And so day after day for weeks, I would start my morning with these three conversations. And it was an amazing way to start my day. It was only when I was listening to something that a different show that you've recorded the other day, where you were talking about how a state of gratitude is similar to a state of flow, that I was like, right, okay, that's why I felt so good every morning through the pandemic. And so to be able to start my day with something so positive and selfishly creatively inspiring, you know, because it's real, it's almost a performance. You know, somebody goes, here's the thing that I'm struggling with. You've got 25 minutes to solve it, or at least give me some kind of direction so that I can leave this conversation feeling better or knowing more or having some clearer sense of direction about what I should do about it. And 7-8 times out of 10, I think I managed to achieve that, right? So there was a creative challenge, no doubt, you know, that satisfied, I suppose, that kind of creative person inside of me, right? But I think that the overriding feeling was one of kind of gratitude and being able to help people. You know, my wife, love my wife, but she is forever telling me how useless I am because I can't fix anything, you know? And, you know, I'm just not a tradesperson in any way, shape or form. If we've got a broken toilet, I'm at a complete loss as to what to do about it. And so I did feel to a degree that this was the first time where I could perhaps be properly useful in terms of the skills that I've acquired. And so to be able to start my day in such a positive way that inspired gratitude in me and in those other people, that I think made a massive difference to, I suppose, my state of mind and, you know, my own confidence levels that one way or another would kind of come out of the other side. And certainly in Australia, you know, it definitely feels like we have, albeit, you know, there's still a long way to go in terms of vaccines and, you know, all those sorts of things. And, you know, who knows, maybe this could happen again before too long. But I think that positivity and gratitude inspired resilience in me, you know, I suppose, to use the kinds of words that you might use. But that's my experience. And it was fun. So.
Yeah, I mean, just going back to reverse engineer that almost, like, starts out with how am I going to, the question was, how am I going to lead through, how do you lead people through adversity, right? Number one, find somebody to serve. Second thing, part of that really is, you know, we receive what we give. And if we're giving this of ourselves in service to somebody else, then the gratitude flows in and the resilience flows in. That sets us up, sets ourselves up to be at our best for the rest of the day. So I think that's awesome. I never thought about it in that context, but really that's what's happening with that whole process you just talked about, which is awesome.
Yeah. I think it's also a Buddhist mentality. So we had the good fortune to work with Olivia Newton-John in creating the brand for her foundation. So I'm guessing you know Olivia Newton-John. No? Grease. Have you heard of the movie Grease? Grease? Grease. John Travolta. And then Sandy, the character, but Sandy's the character, that is Olivia Newton-John. She's kind of a big deal on the planet. Anyhow. And look, I'm not giving away any personal secrets. This is in her book. But when she was diagnosed with cancer, a Buddhist friend of hers, or a friend who practiced Buddhism, their response was, "Congratulations, now you'll grow." And so it's a very Buddhist mentality, that positivity can come out of adversity. And so I'm sure, you know, that may well have kind of played into my mentality at some point. Because the other thing that we did in a commercial context was, like, right when lockdown kicked off, we started surveying our people every 2 weeks, but not surveying them on how are you feeling, are you okay, it's also difficult, etc., etc. It was actually surveying them on the basis that at some point we will come out the other side of this and things may or may not be different. And so what can we learn through this period as we're living and experiencing it that we actually might want to keep doing in the future, or indeed stop doing and go back to how things were, rather than in 6 months' time, let's try and remember what happened and remember how we were feeling, but actually to kind of track that as we were going through it, and on the hypothesis that things are going to be different. We don't know how, but what can we learn from this experience as we're experiencing it that we might want to take forward? And I think for myself and for the team, I think that was enabling as opposed to feeling disabled by being in lockdown. It was enabling because we were trying to find something, or at least open our minds to the possibility that there might be something good that can come out of this. And it might have been a distraction, but I think it was a very healthy, positive, and productive distraction that has indeed played out in exactly that way. In there are things that we learn through those surveys every 2 weeks for 4 months, around technology and culture and creativity and collaboration that we have adopted. And there are other things that we've recognized, we kind of want to go back to, you know, how things were. And so I think that helped focus us on a congratulations, now you'll grow type mentality in the face of adversity.
Rich, we're going to wrap this up. Thanks so much for jumping on here. This was an awesome episode. Can't wait to get it out there for people. Where can people find you online if they want to follow your work?
So LinkedIn is a great place to find me. I spend a fair bit of time on LinkedIn. So Rich Curtis, you know, the website, futurebrand.com, you can find all our latest and greatest work on there. So yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn if you want to have a chat. Always happy to help. Or indeed, if you want 30 minutes of my time, 33, so 30 spelt out and then the number 3, 33.com.au, You can find me there, book time, and we can get up at the start of the day and have a quick chat about all your brand and marketing conundrums.
You're awesome, man. Thanks for all the work that you're doing in the world and for joining us on the show.
Awesome. Take it easy, Mike.
What's up, guys? Thanks for taking the time to listen to the show today. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating on iTunes because it's how we spread the word about the show. Also, remember to grab your copy of Locked In, a digital guide on how to unlock world-class resilient performance by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. We'll see you next week. Even if I fall, I can still get bigger. The definition of a champion, definition of a champion. No. Never for titles, but for survival. The champion, a team.